it's a great loss. But I think for the cause itself is going to be a great gain. In the human struggle for freedom and justice, sacrifices usually enhance the cause, embolden the people who are in resistance.
Do you think that the Iranians are serious about responding?
The problem is with the failure of the Iranians to provide sufficient security for such a high-profile visitor. Of course, later on, the Americans came out officially and denied they had any prior knowledge. And they are liars. They lie. I mean, they've been lying to the world. They've been lying to their nation, to their people.
Tell me a bit about Khalid Mashalan and his approach.
Public opinion is shifting, even if slowly and gradually.
Until last week, all the talk in the West was that of a developing ceasefire agreement for Gaza. The talk now is about a regional conflict. The lead negotiator, Ismail Haniyeh, may Allah have mercy on him and accord him with the status of Shahada, was assassinated in an audacious attack in Tehran. This follows a death of a high-profile Hamas commander, Fawad Chukr, in the southern suburbs of Beirut. There are now fears that the conflict will escalate and more directly involve Iran. Already Hassan Nasrallah, leader of Hezbollah, has talked of revenge, and of course so have the Iranians. Now, to help us navigate this evolving crisis, I am pleased to have back on the show Dr. Azam Tamimi, a political analyst, an expert in the region, and author of a well-researched book on the group Hamas. He joins us today online from Jordan. Dr. Azam Tamimi, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, and welcome back to The Thinking Muslim.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Jazakumullah khairan.
Well, it's wonderful to have you with us. And of course, these are serious times, and it seems like things are escalating in the region. So let's start from what happened this last week. There seems to be a deliberate escalation from Israel. What was Netanyahu thinking when he assassinated Ismail Haniyeh?
Well, Ismail Haniyeh has always been on the Israelis' target list. So if they could get through to him, they probably would have done this at any time. Netanyahu is not at all interested in a ceasefire. He is not at all bothered about the fate of the hostages. Netanyahu is primarily concerned with his own future. And I think he is hoping to keep this war going on, even if necessarily with an escalation of some sort, until Trump takes over in the United States of America. Although, of course, now many people in America don't think that Trump's chances are as high as they were when Biden was a candidate. Yet Netanyahu believes that Trump is his best choice to remain in power, to probably salvage his political future. Now, the problem is not with what the Israelis want to do or do. I mean, it should be expected of them to try and undermine their enemies, to eliminate top leaders in the resistance. And by the way, the guy who was assassinated in Dahiya was not a Hamas figure. He was a Hezbollah figure, to the best of my knowledge. But initially, actually, an American official of some rank leaked news to a major U.S. outlet just about an hour after the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh, or maybe less, that a very senior resistance figure had been eliminated. And that outlet thought it was the same operation in the Dahiya, in the south of Beirut. But it turned to be two separate operations. And probably what the Israelis did in Beirut was a distraction more than anything else, because they were after the bigger fish. The biggest of all fish is, of course, and that was Ismail Haniyeh. So the problem here is not really with what the Israelis might do or think of doing. The problem is with the failure of the Iranians to provide sufficient security for such a high profile visitor who came to attend the inauguration of the new president. And I think the Iranians are now panicking. The Iranians are now confused. Some Iranian officials of certain level have been feeding the international media, and especially recently the New York Times, what I believe is misleading information. And this shows that the Iranians are really not in a very good shape.
Yeah, let's talk about Iran, because there's much speculation that there was a major lapse in security. I mean, one speculation is that the bomb had been in place for many weeks and maybe many months prior to.
I don't think that's credible at all. I mean, at least from my knowledge of Hamas, the Hamas men would have gone through the premises. They would have done a thorough search. It's just incredible that a bomb would have been planted there 2 months in advance. I mean, how could they tell that on this very day, at this very hour, Ismail Haniyeh was going to be in bed in that place? And it doesn't make sense. When I spoke to Khalid Mishal just a few hours after we heard the news, he told me that the information they had, that it was a drone of some sort. Probably not. We don't know. It's still not clear. But what is really clear is that there is a major Iranian failure here. I'm not accusing anybody of anything, but maybe apart from carelessness, apart from allowing themselves to be penetrated by a Mossad cell of some sort or a Mossad agent.
How do you think Iran will respond to this? Because, as you said, it was humiliating for Iran to have such a high-profile person killed on its soil. And there's already talk about punishing the Israelis. Now, we know that Iran has shown major restraint in the past. In the April attacks on Israel, or symbolic attacks on Israel, it had well telegraphed its approach prior to those missile attacks. How do you feel that the Iranians will respond to this?
Well, we've heard the Iranians threaten. Khamenei himself on the first day made such big threats. Mm. Hezbollah in Lebanon threatened. The Houthis in Yemen have threatened. So we have Iran and its proxies telling us that Israel would be punished. Well, it is yet to be seen. Iran is a state, is a government. Governments usually have different calculus, different reckoning, different calculations, because of the mesh of interests they have at the economic, political, and diplomatic levels. So I think they will probably be thinking a lot before they perhaps carry out an attack or a revenge act of some sort that might draw the entire region into a major conflict. Yet on the other side, if the Iranians don't do anything, or if they don't do anything credible or tangible, that will be really it for them. Iran will probably never be seen as credible, will never be respected. And I think above all, this assassination has sent messages around the world that Iran is not a safe place. I personally knew this for a while, because so many Iranian scientists, technicians, and politicians were eliminated and were assassinated by Mossad agents operating on Iranian territory. And I don't think that the regime in Iran has a strategy or has a mechanism for combating this or for doing anything about it.
Do you think that the Iranians are serious about responding? I mean, there's a lot of debate about the efficacy of the axis of resistance and whether it's just maintained a symbolic status quo rather than responded to the horrid events in Gaza. I mean, how do you analyze Iran and its proxies and how they negotiate what is taking place in Gaza and, of course, the West Bank?
Well, I, among many people, would have understood that Iran shouldn't or cannot or wouldn't hit Israel for what Israel is doing in Gaza. But when Iran is directly violated, when its sovereignty and its integrity and its reputation are at stake, you'd expect them to do something about this. Because if they don't, that means their vulnerability will be enhanced. Now, how they will respond, will they or will they not respond? I'm not in the business of predicting. I'm not very good. I'm not good at all at predicting what's likely to happen. But their record hasn't been that good. Because in Syria, for instance, they were hit so many times, dozens of times by the Israelis. And they lost many of their operatives, some at senior level, and yet their response, if at all, was very mild indeed.
Back to Netanyahu, I mean, do you feel that he is seriously looking for a regional war? Or does he recognize Iran will remain restrained and this is no more than continuing the war, as you said, for political, domestic political reasons?
I think Netanyahu knows Iranian weakness, Iranian vulnerability. And he is probably exploiting that. He knows that Iran is keen on keeping the oil flowing from its territory to China and to other importers. He knows very well that the sanctions are hurting the Iranians. He knows that a significant segment of the Iranian people do not support the regime and they do not like the fact that the regime in Tehran supports the Palestinians or supports Hezbollah or the Houthis or any of the proxies. Yet, at the same time, Netanyahu doesn't care about expanding the war. I think that's a price he is willing to pay in exchange for his own political survival. His political survival is paramount for him. This is what he is aiming at. Also, Netanyahu knows that the United States of America would never relinquish him, would never renounce him, would never stop pumping money and weapons into his regime. He knows Western Europe as governments, despite the change, the massive change in public opinion, will still provide them with diplomatic and political cover. So he's acting with sheer impunity. And therefore his calculations are not like yours or mine in this regard.
Yet you say that he's holding out for a Trump presidency and that Trump would be more favorable towards him and his government and maybe the state of Israel. But what we see, the facts on the ground are that Biden has given him the green light and provided him with all of the material, monetary and diplomatic support to prosecute this Gaza genocide. So what is it that Trump would add to Netanyahu that Biden does not give him?
Well, you are right. The Biden administration has been giving Netanyahu everything, nearly everything he asked for. And finally, he was invited to address Congress. Although the invitation did not come from the Biden administration, I think it came from Congress itself.
Republican.
Yet I think the difference here is that the tension that exists between the Biden administration and Netanyahu, and it's realistic. I mean, it's there. We cannot deny it. Would not be there in the case of Trump. There would be no tension. I think Trump, who is the candidate of the evangelicals in the United States of America, who is the candidate of the extreme right wing in America, will just be on exactly the same he will be doing exactly what Netanyahu would want him to do. So probably in this regard, I think also under a Trump administration, the various institutions in the U.S. government will lose their, I wouldn't call it veto, but their willingness to tell the president, this is not in the interest of the United States of America. We shouldn't be doing this, or we should be doing that, etc. So I'm not here trying to say that the Biden administration for us is better than the Trump administration, but I'm trying to understand the way that Netanyahu is thinking. In terms of Trump being a much better ally than Biden, despite all the assistance that Biden has given to Netanyahu.
So can I ask you about the United States? Because, of course, there is a schizophrenia maybe at the top of the administration. On one level, tonally, they do often criticize the Netanyahu government, but of course practically for all intents and purposes they've given an absolute green light to this. The Harris presidency could potentially tonally shift even more. We've seen a recently there was a speech where she heavily criticized Netanyahu and his policies. Do you think it's just surface level, and you know, on a deeper level, for example, with regards to this assassination, do you believe that the United States knew in advance that Ismail Haniyeh was to be targeted and maybe even assisted in that endeavor?
I firmly believe that the United States of America at least knew beforehand about the assassination plot. They might even have been on it, embroiled in it, involved. I received a message at 2:30 Jordan time, which is half an hour past midnight in London, on that night, telling me that according to a senior American official, senior resistance personality has been eliminated. Now, the source didn't know any more details, and probably they thought it was included in the South Beirut operation, not elsewhere, as we discovered afterwards. When I sent to my friend Khaled Mishal in Doha, asking him upon the request of that of the media outlet that contacted me, whether they could deny or confirm that one of their top officials had been eliminated, he couldn't tell what I was talking about, because it was linked to South Beirut, and in South Beirut they didn't have anybody in that location. And they hadn't received the news from Tehran until 2 hours later. Because when I asked him, when did you know about Haniyeh's assassination? He said 4:30. 4:30 is 2:30 London time, London summer time. So the American official who contacted the media outlets to tell them about this, he knew, someone knew, and probably they were just paving the way for what was going to come. Of course, later on, the Americans came out officially and denied they had any prior knowledge. And they are liars. They lie. I mean, they've been lying to the world. They've been lying to their nation, to their people. Now, the other part of your question is about a likely Harris administration. Probably not much will change if she becomes president. However, I think she will be more receptive to the voices within the Democratic camp in America that criticize Israel or condemn Netanyahu and to some extent support the Palestinians or sympathize with their plight. Because this is happening within the Democratic Party, within the Democratic constituency. It's not happening among the Republicans, but it's happening within the Democrats. And of course, these things build up. And as probably we discussed before in a previous meeting, that the events that we have been seeing since the 7th of October have been analyzed by some experts as being very similar to what happened in 1968 when it came to the Vietnamese struggle. Eventually, there was a change. Change happened. There was a shift in public opinion in America, in France, elsewhere in the world. And a few years later, the Americans withdrew from Vietnam. So it's important. What is happening within the Democratic Party and what is happening among the students and the youth in America is significant. We shouldn't at all underestimate it.
But there is a predicament then for Muslims in America. And of course, as you know, there has been a very long-running campaign to punish Biden, calling him Genocide Joe and Abandon Biden campaign, which was primarily led by Muslims and conscientious progressives in America. With Biden gone, there is now a prospect of a Harris presidency where, as you said, materially nothing will change, but she may tonally at least be more receptive to these voices. I've received a number of messages from Muslims in America asking for direction. Where do we go on you know, in the coming election is the advice they seek. I mean, how do you respond to this very difficult choice that Muslims have at the ballot box in November?
Well, the difficulty in America is that you don't really have much choice. You have just two contenders, and the decision you make will have to be based on who is the lesser evil. Unfortunately, this is how it works. And if I were an American citizen, I would definitely vote for Harris, but not for Trump. Mm. I mean, Trump is a disaster. Disaster for everybody. Disaster for America. Disaster for us. Disaster for everybody. Of course, I would vote for Harris in the hope that this will embolden the segment within the Democratic constituency that is changing perception when it comes to the conflict in the Middle East. You need to build on that. Because what other choice have you? I mean, boycotting the elections is, in my opinion, never a solution. Because elections will continue, whether with a large number of votes or a small number of votes, someone will win eventually. So you try to influence the process in the best possible way you think. And this would be my advice to them.
Now, when we consider what happens next, you've spoken to Khalid Mashal, and he's been placed, tapped as really the next, the likely replacement to Ismail Haniyeh. Tell me a bit about Khalid Mashal and his approach to this crisis.
Well, Khaled Mishal is a personal friend. We went to school together. I mean, since young age, since we were boys, we remained in contact since then. And Khaled Mishal has good experience. Probably he is the most experienced politician and diplomat within the Hamas movement. And this was clearly seen during his term or his terms in office. He served from 2005 until 2017. Sorry, from he served from 1995 until 2017. And during that tenure, he met with world leaders. He met with, I mean, former world leaders. He met with President Carter more than once. He met with so many others, diplomats, politicians. He received prominent journalists from around the world. And toward the last few months of his last term, he met several times with even Tony Blair, who was keen on talking business with Hamas. And before Hamas was proscribed by the British and by the Europeans, many Europeans and British acting politicians, as well as former politicians, as well as journalists and academics, went and met him and had discussions with him. Everybody really agreed that this was a statesman. Khaled Mishal is a real statesman. And now that Haniyeh has been eliminated, according to the rules in the movement, one of the three deputies of Haniyeh would step in and be acting head of the political bureau until the new elections are held. Elections are due, actually, but they couldn't be held because of the war and because of the situation in Gaza. Now, the three deputies are the heads of the provinces or the constituencies. Hamas has three constituencies: Gaza, the West Bank, and the diaspora. The head of Gaza is Sinwar, but Sinwar cannot replace Haniyeh because he is in Gaza. According to the rules, the top leader has to be out of occupied Palestine in order not to be under Israeli pressure or threat. The head of the West Bank has already been eliminated, Aruri, in January. And now we are left with the head of the diaspora organization, who is Khaled Mishal. And I think despite the great loss the movement incurs as a result of the elimination of Ismail Haniyeh, who was a great man, and I've known him for many years, Khaled Mishal will be good news for Hamas.
I haven't asked you about prospects for a ceasefire. I understand there is another meeting tabled in Cairo in a few days' time. Do you see the ceasefire negotiations to be very much a charade, and it's Netanyahu has no real will to pursue any end anytime soon to this genocide?
Exactly. That's what I believe, and I think that's what most people within Hamas also would agree to. Yet, my understanding is that Hamas has not, despite this charade, has not and probably will not, probably, I say probably will not, withdraw from the negotiations.
Why?
And simply because they're calling Netanyahu's bluff. Netanyahu is simply not interested, and he's waiting for the moment when Hamas will say, it's useless, we're not going to Cairo, we're not going to have these discussions. Now, this is not what they've been saying, despite the genocide that continues to be perpetrated against the Palestinians in Gaza, as well as in the West Bank, by the way, simply because they want the world to understand that they are not the obstacle. And I think people understand this now.
Moving on to more international actors, I mean, China has been quite active in bringing together the different parties in the Palestinian set. And there was a meeting and an agreement held in Beijing a few weeks ago where the different factions came together and agreed to work together. I mean, what's your analysis of China's role in this conflict? I note that they condemned Netanyahu's assassination of Ismail Haniyeh. How do you understand China in this mix?
Well, China, Russia, and some other players are seeking to find a place for themselves in this conflict. I doubt that this is going to have a significant impact, simply because the Israelis don't recognize these initiatives, but also because the Chinese and the Russians, when they do things of this sort, it's more of a PR, really, than anything else. Take, for instance, the recent Beijing meeting where they brought the various Palestinian factions. It's impossible. You cannot have reconciliation. You cannot have unification. So long as one major faction, which is the Fatah faction, that is leading or that is in charge of the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah, are actually collaborating with the occupation. They're serving the occupation. They're informing on resistance activists. And they're conspiring against the resistance in Gaza. So all these endeavors are not really worth much. With regard to attempts to reconcile Fatah and Hamas, these go as far back as at least 2005. And they never worked, because eventually whatever the two sides agree on will have to be passed by the Israelis, and usually the Israelis veto the whatever is agreed upon, and the Fatah guys change their mind. So yes, it's probably a PR. And from Hamas' point of view, which happens today to be proscribed in many countries or restricted in others, including many Arab countries, any opportunity to open up diplomatic or political channels, they'd welcome them.
There is a discussion here in the West about what we can do to end this crisis, or at least to contribute to building public and political pressure against this genocide. We've demonstrated, we've used a ballot box, we've used a number of means to apply pressure on Israel, but it all seems to not have that effect. Netanyahu today acts with impunity. Is there anything we can do within our control as Muslims in the West to address more forthright this issue and to find an end to the crisis?
I think the first thing we need to do is never to lose hope, never to be desperate or despondent and say, oh, it doesn't work. We've tried everything and it doesn't work. No, we have to continue to do more, even if of the same. And I think we saw in the election that the activism, not just the Muslims were engaged in, but the supporters of Palestine as a whole of varying backgrounds, were really matter. These efforts mattered. Yeah. They made a slight difference. They didn't bring to 10 Downing Street someone who is supportive of the Palestinians. But I think that guy knows today that Palestine matters and that public opinion is shifting, even if slowly and gradually. And I don't think we can do more than this. We have to continue to work with others to bring awareness to the public, to hopefully bring pressure to bear on decision makers at the level of at the national level, at the local level, at all levels possible. And eventually, our efforts, together with the efforts of others elsewhere, but above all, the steadfastness, the resilience, and the patience, and the forbearance, and the sacrifices made by the people of Palestine, and the people of Gaza in particular, Hopefully this will combine together and bring about the desired change in the world.
Finally, Dr. Azam, you've met with Ismail Haniyeh on many occasions, and you knew him, and you've got to understand what he was about as a man and as a leader, as a resistance leader. Tell me a little bit about Ismail Haniyeh.
Well, Ismail Haniyeh was a very young man when Hamas started. Yet from a very, very young age, he was involved in the activism. He was imprisoned by the Israelis several times. Eventually, he was deported among the 400 and so leaders of Hamas and Islamic Jihad to South Lebanon. Then when Sheikh Ahmed Yassin was released from prison after the assassination attempt on the life of Khalid Mish'al in Jordan in 1997, he was appointed personal assistant to Sheikh Ahmed Yassin and manager of his office. And my contacts with him started at that time, since 1997. But then I visited him several times in Gaza between 2010 and 2013. He received me in his house in the refugee in Ashatta refugee camp, which is a very modest dwelling. And the man is just someone you cannot but love, really. Very softly spoken, very polite, very humble, knowledgeable. And when he speaks to the masses, he's a great orator. People love them within the movement as well as among a significant segment of the population of Gaza. He was the one person people do not disagree on. This even showed more clearly when he became head of the Politburo in 2017. So after that, when he left Gaza and settled in Doha, I also visited him several times, and we kept in touch all along. Of course, for people who were close to him, people who knew him, it's a great loss. But I think for the cause itself is going to be a great gain, because martyrdom, not just in Islamic culture, by the way, it's in the human struggle for freedom and justice. Sacrifices usually enhance the cause, embolden the people who are in resistance. But more so in Islam, because in Islam, if you are struggling for justice and truth, you can hope for one of two outcomes. There is no third outcome. Either martyrdom or victory. And both are considered success. So martyrdom in the way that Netanyahu was martyred is a personal loss for people who loved him and who were close to him. But it's a great gain for the movement. And I think this will show. And the history of the movement also proves this. Since the movement was, since Hamas was born in 1987, the Israelis eliminated dozens of top leaders and top operators. Yet the movement never weakened. Its resolve was never weakened. And it continued to grow in strength as well as in popularity. And I expect the same result after this assassination.
Dr. Azam Tamimi, it's really a pleasure speaking to you today. Jazakallah khair. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Please remember to subscribe to our social media and YouTube channels, and head over to our website, thinkingmuslim.com, to sign up to my weekly newsletter. Jazakallah khair.